Okay, Mackenzie.
Okay, Lamar.
It's hook time, and I wanted to know, I guess, two-part question. Number one, if you could select an age to stay for the remainder of your life, like how old would you want to stay as if you were a lost boy in this film? And I guess, secondly, would you even want that ability? Like, let's say you were a kid and you had the ability to stay in Neverland and never age. Is that even something you want?
I mean, I probably, in retrospect, yes, but that was kind of what I was wondering when I was watching this movie too, is I was like, as a kid, do kids actually want to stay kids? Because
No, they want to grow. And what the
all,
fuck do they know? They're
right.
kids. Like, what did I
They're
know when I
kids,
was
they're
that
dumb.
age?
Exactly. And I think that's like, that's the dichotomy of living, right? Like when you're a kid, you want to be, all you want to be is an adult. And when you're an adult, all you want to be is a kid. So I think you would have been very hard pressed to sell me on Neverland as a kid. Like I would have been like hard pass. I'm gonna go adult. I'm gonna go do all the adult things because I'm basically an adult already, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, as an adult, definitely I would so appreciate being a kid again. I wonder what the age would be though. Probably like I think maybe preteen years, because I feel like preteen years is when you start fucking shit up. You know what I mean? Like things start to get hard or
I was
dramatic
gonna
or
say,
people
like
get, you know,
pre-puberty,
like
it has to be before puberty for me.
100%. Because I feel like I just was having the most fun. I was like so outdoorsy and I was athletic and I was like playing games and I wasn't at all self-conscious yet, really. You know, I was in that early phase of just like, I am who I am and I'm awesome, you know?
But
Like,
if you wait until you're 13, then suddenly you
but if
lose
you're
that
13,
confidence. You never
yeah,
want to go
you're
outside.
self-conscious. Yeah,
I
you're
was gonna
self-conscious
say
about
for me,
everything.
if I waited until I hit puberty, I would never leave my room for a different reason, which would be fun for me, but not for the other Lost Boys. They'd be like, "Where's Lamar? Oh, he's in his room again." Just, yeah, I don't want to go back
Wonder
there.
what he's doing in there all by himself. Oh, if only we had learned when we were children. If only we knew.
If only we knew. Could have avoided all this fucking back pain.
Yeah, I would opt out of adulthood just to not feel the pains and the groans of being an adult, for sure. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing Spielberg Month, November.
November.
It's still, we got some suggestions. I don't know if you saw them. Some people sent us some
Oh, did we
suggestions.
get names? What were they? Do you know them off the top of your head?
Yeah, there was one that was like, I think it was like Spielberg something. It was like Spielberg instead, like just November, Spielberg. But yeah, we had a couple suggestions, and I just feel like this is a hard one to riff on. I feel like I can't.
That's what I'm
I feel like
saying. You've had 3 weeks at this point to come up with a better name, and we just keep rolling. So,
you're not wrong. Okay, here's what they were. I'm sorry, I misrepresented then. Stevenberg
Stevenberg.
and Steven Novemberg. Those were our
I get it
suggestions.
could have
Which.
been, but he goes by Steven, not Steve. Otherwise, I would say like Stevember, but like I still feel like
Yeah.
Novemberg. I know it's not his whole name, but I think that flows the best out of those options.
I do think it flows. I think my thing is the clarity, right? Like, I don't think it's as clear who we're talking
We could be
about.
doing Peter Berg movies, the guy who
We
did
could,
Friday Night Lights. Like,
be doing a lot of things,
we
I
could do
feel
movies
like.
about icebergs only, so
Icebergs, exactly.
Titanic,
That's where I
and
was going with it, is
I
like,
don't
we
know
could be
what
talking about
else,
iceberg
but
movies.
yeah.
Anyway, all that to say, we haven't done anything better. I haven't done anything better. And we're doing Novemberg. But this week, we're definitely shifting gears from last week's entry. We are doing Hook.
Which I, spoiler guys, I loved this movie as a kid, and I'm gonna have to rate this today on what childhood Lamar would give it and what adult Lamar gives it, because it has not aged well for me personally. There's things I
Oh
like
my
about it, but I do not
God.
love this film as an adult.
Wow. Okay. You guys are in for an interesting episode because I have a lot of feelings. All
I
right.
have back pain now. We've been through this.
He's super not in his Peter Pan era, is what we've
No, I'm in my
determined.
Peter,
So
whatever is Peter. What's his real name in the real world now?
Peter
Peter
Banning. Peter
Banning. I'm in
Banning
my
era.
Peter Banning era right now.
Okay, well, that's lame. Let's power through with a drink. What is it?
All right. This one's fun. So we kind of riffed on this a little bit, but it's 2 ounces of rum. I used spiced rum in honor of the pirates in this movie. An ounce each of pineapple and orange juice, and then 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, as well as ginger liqueur. And then here's the fun part is this was Skylar's idea to do at Craft World, to do a hot honey rim with cinnamon sugar on it. And that is making the drink for me. It's really fucking good.
Yeah, I was I debated that one at length with him, and he was adamant it would be delicious. And then he actually made mine today and didn't do it.
He didn't do the room for you. You're missing out. This is a tasty concoction.
I'm giving him shit later.
I know you can buy hot honey in the store. I just mixed regular honey with sriracha.
We have hot honey. He could have done it.
It exists.
I don't know why he did this to me. Anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
Yours looks a little bit yellower. Mine's a little oranger. He did say he riffed on it as he is wont to do when left to his own devices. So I don't know what he did exactly.
And we're calling this one, what else? It has to be Bangarang, right?
I mean, I even told you this over text when we were planning this out. And I was like, well, I'll let you know if anything else jumps out to me. And no, nothing else.
Nah, dude, it's got to be Bangarang. I didn't know it. That's an actual, I mean, it's not in Webster's dictionary, but apparently it's a Jamaican term for like discord or making a ruckus.
Disruption. So, yeah. Anarchy. But like,
I think the rim on this is really, really helping that out.
Absolutely. Okay. So as you can tell, I think Lamar and I are going to disagree on this one slightly today. I am ready to fangirl a little bit. Like, I love Peter Pan in general. I have the nerd edition of the Peter Pan, which is, if y'all didn't know, the source material is J.M. Barrie's works. J.M. Barrie was incredible author and the mind behind Peter Pan and did a ton of stuff beyond just Peter Pan. It's like a bunch of plays. They did Peter and Wendy. There's a whole series all about the Lost Boys. And this is the really beautiful illustrated and annotated edition. So it's one of my favorite things in my library. So I was super excited to do this today.
That's very cool. As we know, I don't read or can't read. So I did not bring a prop today. But I do want to say up front of the thought that I had was I loved this more when I was a kid than when as an adult, but you have to watch this as a kid's film. Like, I know it's Spielberg, but you have to watch this as a children's movie. It's at this time in the early 90s where kids' movies were basically for kids, adult movies were basically for adults. And it was hard to get one where when Pixar comes around, that's the norm nowadays, is as a 40-year-old, I can go see Coco or any of these other films that pack this emotional weight. As an adult, this is trying to walk a line where it feels like half the movie is made for kids and half the movie is made for adults. And it's also a fairy tale at the end of the day, as it's a spin on a fairy tale, but you have to watch it with those caveats, I think, in mind to really enjoy it as an adult, at least if you've waited 30 years to rewatch it like I did.
Well, I think this is the indicator, right? Like, there are people, there's a dividing line between critics' assessments and audience assessments. And I think that's part of why, and like how you go into it and how you watch it is a huge part of it. So we'll get into some basics here really quick. Hook, as we know, is 1991. So it was like early 90s movie. This is a 6.8 out of 10 on IMDb. So like, pretty decent showing. Mm-hmm. But when we get to the Rotten Tomatoes of it all,
it's very
shit
interesting.
Goes awry. Yeah. So the critics, the adult slash pirates, gave it 29%. And the audience gave it 76%. The Lost Boys slash the kids. I'm just saying, I think that's
still his worst, like on Rotten Tomatoes, like it's still his worst reviewed film from the critics' perspective. But I do think it says a lot that
Crystal Skull is. I thought Crystal. At least on IMDb, it's definitely lower. Like Crystal Skull is 6.2, something like that. So yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is a divisive film. It's kind of not. It's to some degree always confused me, but I agree. I think it's part of like how you watch it when you watch it for the first time, and do you have any nostalgia with it as well? So did you see it for the first time as a kid? Like it then? Okay.
I liked it as a kid. I think I watched it probably 3 or 4 times in the first few years after it came out. And then I just did not rewatch it for decades.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. All right. Let's blow through some basics. and then we'll get to the fun stuff. So obviously Steven Spielberg, as we said, he's done 1 million things. He did Munich. He did The Adventures of Tintin. What's another one? Ready Player One that we haven't mentioned. So just throwing out different ones for you every single week. J.M. Barrie is the originating author, as we said, of the source material and all the works about Peter Pan. He was actually a very successful author on other topics, but like this is his most famous works, plural, around Peter Pan.
What other topics does he do? Like religion?
He does other third world country. I don't. Largely other children's work. Yes.
The science of cloning. He's done a couple books on that.
A lot of historical nonfiction. He tried to write
a sequel to the Kama Sutra. That didn't go over well.
I'm sorry, J.M. Barrie. I just want to apologize for my co-host here. Anyway, no, he did the original work, which there are a lot of great lines from the original play referenced in the film, which is really fun. And I think maybe even more than like Disney's take on this, for example. So like, I feel like it's a little bit more authentic in that way. Okay. But we also have Jim V. Hart, who did the screen story / screenplay. He's done things like August Rush, Muppet Treasure Island.
That was the one that didn't surprise me at all. Cause I was like, this kind of feels like this movie feels like a combination of a Jim Henson film. And if Mel Brooks made a straight up children's movie. So the fact that this writer went on to do Muppet Treasure Island did not surprise me in the least.
But it might surprise you that he did Bram Stoker's Dracula. So also we have Nick Castle, who contributed as well, largely to the story, the screen story. Also,
did you see the
August
story
Rush
about him, though? Of like, he was apparently originally supposed to direct. He was He wrote the base screenplay and was slated to direct. And then the studio was like, fucking Spielberg wants in, buddy, you got to go. So they paid him out a lump sum and he got a portion that the movie ended up making. But he didn't really have much else to do aside from that original screenplay. But do you know my favorite credit of Nick Castle's?
Escape from New York?
No. So he did do Escape from New York.
But
where do I know this name from? He plays Michael Myers in the original Halloween and in like the last three sequels.
Oh my God.
This guy played Michael Myers and then went on
and he directs. He does everything. He can do anything. This guy can do anything. Yeah. Oh, sorry you got outed for Spielberg, Nick, but I mean, like, I probably would have done the same thing. You know what I mean? Like,
hold a grudge.
Yeah. Okay, let's get some major cast and crew. I just want to asterisk this. I am not going to do all the wonderful, sweet Lost Boy children. I would love to, but one, a lot of them haven't done other things, and two, there's way too many of them. Jeez. So I'm sticking to the high level basics here. Robin Williams, as we know, plays Peter Pan / Peter Banning. Done a bazillion things, which we have talked about on the pod before, but a couple of refreshers: Mrs. Doubtfire, Good Morning Vietnam, Patch Adams is always one that I think of personally, but I think no one else thinks of. But yeah, he's done everything as well. So
apparently, his chest for this role, like, because I do remember as a kid seeing Hairy Williams, and he's a very hairy man. So in this, I was like, I wonder what the thought was there. It's a children's movie, Robin. Damn it.
Well, he's gotta look young like Peter. I could see when he goes into Peter Pan mode. You know, if you see his manly arm hair, it's gonna like take away from the aesthetic, I think.
Well, they have him magically change outfits and shit whenever he turns into Peter Pan. Like, there's a lot of that in this film of like suddenly somebody's wearing a different costume. They could have just had him shed his body hair. To show that he'd become a boy again. I think that could have been a lesson to all of us.
I feel like that would have been like getting too much into the little traumatizing into like the reverse puberty of it all. I don't know. I feel like maybe that's too much. But we also have another legend, Mr. Dustin Hoffman, which, fun fact, and I roasted the shit out of him for this, Skylar did not know who was playing Hook while we were watching it. He was like, who is this guy? I was like, costume is great. His costume is great. And it's not like super clear, but I feel like you can see the vestiges of Mr. Hoffman. He's awesome.
I mean, I get it though, because I feel like as a kid, I definitely didn't know who it was. And then I think it wasn't until 10 or 20 years later that I was like, who was that again? Oh shit, it was Dustin Hoffman. I feel like I Mandela affected myself into thinking it was Tim Curry or someone similar. But I feel like now you look back on it and you're like, it had to be Dustin Hoffman. He fucking kills it.
He does kill it. He's obviously, again, legendary. But I think fun fact about him, and if you haven't seen this, I highly recommend it. He is also in Finding Neverland, which is the story of how J.M. Barrie came up with this this whole universe. And it is based on a true story. The Llewellyn Davies family is a family that he became very close with and inspired the characters. And the Finding Neverland film, which is like Johnny Depp, Kate Winslet, and Dustin Hoffman is in it as well, tells the story of how they meet, how they come up with these characters, like all these really, it's a really beautiful film. It will make you cry. But he is in that as well and does a great job. And that's a great movie. Again, Peter Pan adjacent, if you love Peter Pan like me.
Is that one super similar to, what was the one we watched for Christmas last year where it was the guy writing, or was the Dickens story that was similar? It was him in the process.
The Man Who Invented Christmas. Yes.
Okay. Similar like to that, because I haven't seen Finding Neverland.
It is kind of similar in that it is definitely like taking you through the author's process for sure. Okay. I think I know that was like very fantastical and magical, but I think it's like almost more magical. It's really interesting. It really is a combination of this real life story of this person meeting this family and becoming close with this family, but then the Neverland kind of comes to life before your eyes, okay. I think is kind of the thing I would say. It's really beautiful. I think it's a really good film.
Yeah, I'll add it to the list.
Yeah. He also did, of course, some other fun ones. Tootsie, Rain Man, Midnight Cowboy. He has an 85 plus films. We cannot name them all. Whatever. He's a legend. We love
Meet
him.
Meet the Fockers.
Meet the
Is that in your top five, Dustin?
It definitely wasn't, but leave it to you to bring it on board. We can't leave Meet the Fockers out. We also have Julia Roberts, who, again, done a bazillion things, plays Tinkerbell or Tinkerhell, unfortunately, as she was referenced while working on this film multiple times.
And I thought that while watching it, I'm like, she's got to be just on a soundstage by herself for 90% of this movie. She hardly ever gets to interact with anybody. She's probably just green screening it. And yes,
which, let's
point,
be fair, I feel like that would make you miserable on this set of all sets. You would have the worst FOMO, you know what I mean? Of just like, I want to be where the kids are, like where the fun is,
I would be fine with not being near where all those fucking kids are. Apparently that was like stressful for Spielberg.
I was going to say, you and Steven Spielberg both, apparently, because he actually gives a lot of shit to this film because he said it was really hard to make with all these kids, which, again, I get it. I see the logistics of it, but I still think it like, again, if you're watching it as a kid and you're like, this looks like so much fun. Anyway, Julie Roberts, again, Aaron Brockovich, Closer, Charlie Wilson's War, all kinds of good stuff. Bob Hoskins, who plays Smee, hasn't done
Mr. Smee.
He's hasn't done a ton of things that I think people would know him for in film specifically. He's done a lot of TV, but a handful of film stuff he's done is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which
big one. Yeah.
I always have loved. He actually also did the TV miniseries Neverland, where he is Smee again. And Mermaids. He did Mermaids with Cher, if you ever saw that. And then just, again, lots of other TV stuff.
You're leaving out the best. You keep leaving out everyone's best movies. He was in the Super Mario Brothers live action with John Leguizamo that everyone loves.
You mean the one that was universally panned?
That's the thing. I was talking to Janelle about it this week, and she was like, I've never seen that. And I'm like, it's not even a so bad it's good film. It's just a bad movie.
Yeah, for sure. And I love John Leguizamo. So I do not want to give that man shit for a single thing that he does, but it's bad. Maggie Smith, another legend, obsessed, love her, adore her, was McGonagall for Halloween. I can't remember if we've already talked about this, but obsessed with her, RIP Maggie Smith. She plays Granny Wendy. And what's funny is that she really does look like the older version of herself in this, but she's actually only in her 50s here, and they had to like age her way up. Mm-hmm. And they did what I would say in retrospect is they did a very good job, because she ended up basically just looking like that. But yes, she's in all the Harry Potters. She's done Godsford Park. First Wives Club is actually, I think, a really fun turn for her, where she's a really different character. Done a lot of Shakespeare. She's done a ton of stuff. She's awesome. Caroline Goodall, not one that as many people know. She's Moira. She's the mom of the kiddos. She doesn't have as much screen time, but I do think she's important, and she's talked about a lot. She did Disclosure, and probably more recently known for doing The Crown on Netflix, the new iteration. Yeah. Charlie Corsmo, who we have talked about on the pod before.
I was going to say, we have, at this point, we have done two Charlie Corsmo movies which and is no crazy. Matt Damon's, which validates what I said last week. We fucking hate Matt Damon.
Stop lumping me in with that. We're going to get roasted. Yeah, no, we have not done Matt Damon justice, but we have done Charlie Corsmo quite a bit of justice.
Charlie Corsmo only has like four movies, and we've done two of them.
He only has four movie credits, and we've done two out of the four. Yeah,
quality over quantity, buddy.
I mean, he's judicious in his choices is what mm-hmm. we've determined for sure. He plays Jackie, who is an annoying little kid, but also like kind of you get it. Anyway, we'll get there. He obviously did Can't Hardly Wait. The only other thing that people probably know him from is Dick Tracy. He has not been in a lot of stuff. Amber Scott has been in even less, but we got to mention her. She plays Maggie Banning. She is fucking adorable in this movie. I think she was like, this is the cutest I'm ever going to be. All done. And
she's
basically
doing
retired.
The right amount of kid acting. Like, as rough as the opening play is at their school when they're watching the play, she's yeah. just doing that for the rest of the movie. Like, this, like, I'm 10 years old and I have to act really loud, but it works for.
And
for
I'm adorable. And so yeah. I can pull it off. Yeah. Yeah, it totally works. She's done like one other thing, American Experience, and that's it. She's done some production stuff, but even that, just not a ton.
Yeah, I actually had like an entire half page of notes on the children's play at the start of how bad it is. I was like, here's my 27% wow. Rotten Tomatoes review for this children's play.
You roasted the play within the movie that the movie is not about. Wow. Wow. He's bitter, folks. He's real bitter. Arthur Mallett. These are the two honorable mentions, I will say, from The Lost Boys. I'm not going to go into them all, but these I think are really important. Arthur Mallett plays Toodles, which is really important in the book itself and the plays, and then I think he kind of like ties up with a bow at the end there. It's very sweet. He is in Mary Poppins, Halloween, Secret of Nim, which is another fun kids animated film, which I used to love. But he does such a good job of Toodles in this one, and I think it's really cute. And then the last one, we gotta mention Dante Bosco as Rufio.
Rufio.
He did Take the Lead, which is like in the era of all the dance movies like that. You remember when we were like doing okay, like that's okay.
If I was gonna,
up and
if, yeah, if I had to hypothesize the name of other dance movies that I never watched or saw trailers for, that would be Take the Lead's pretty solid. Yeah.
Listen, Step Up was pretty good. Like, I'm not going to talk shit. Like, Step Up was a good time, but like it got out of hand. I will say it definitely did get out of hand, but Take the Lead was one of them. He's been in a few shorts. He's been in a lot of TV. Hasn't done a ton since, but he was like, I remember him being integral to this film, and he has a lot happens with him in this film.
Say,
so,
we'll get into the spoilers, but Rufio did nothing wrong. We got to talk about that. Rufio did nothing wrong.
Justice for Rufio.
Yeah.
And music again. This is my favorite part of this shtick every week. John fucking Williams. Here again, doing the music at legendary as always. It is fun to identify little riffs too, though, from
that
other.
That sort of, yeah, because this is like his... listening to it. I went, this isn't my favorite Williams score because it feels like three other Williams scores that I like better. There's a little bit of Harry Potter in there.
It's
for
a
sure.
little bit, yeah. It has a little bit of Star Wars, a little bit of Harry Potter, a little bit of a couple other things. But fun factoid, he recorded like. Oh, more content for this than all of his other films combined, and it's never been released. He actually had so much that he had composed for this film they couldn't use it all, and I think it's something like it's like three additional hours of music that was recorded that was never used.
Make another fucking movie.
Yeah, but it was also like something to do with the licensing, and they can't use it, so they've never released it. So anyway, he did a lot of other work for this, and I would be so curious to hear it because, again, to your point, like there's a lot of these other film references in this score, and I wonder what we didn't hear. Anyway,
I hope it's all just like 80s power metal songs. Like they're like, John, this does not fit the theme of the movie. I mean, it was early 90s, which means they were probably doing all the music and stuff in the late 80s, so he's probably on a lot of cocaine. And they were just like, we can't use any of this shit, John.
You have a cocaine obsession this morning. Like, are you having a day?
Cocaine obsession every morning, McKenzie.
Yeah, okay. Checks out.
I did want to shout out, though, before we move on past the cast and the crew here, is we weren't going to go through all the Lost Boys, but I was curious going through their IMDBs and looking at all their nicknames. Because, like, you don't really, you hear
well,
each
these
name
are from.
Once.
These are from the play, with the exception of Don't Ask. Anyway, continue.
Okay, so that's the one that I wanted to focus on, because you have, like, Latch Boy, you have Toodles, obviously, you have Pockets, you have Ace, Too Small, Thud Butt, who ends up, you know, being pretty integral to the story. But Don't Ask, the actor, apparently he didn't have a name at the beginning, and he kept pestering Spielberg to be like, what's my character's name? What's my character's name? And eventually, after like a month of this, Spielberg, the kid was walking up to me, and he goes, Don't Ask. And that ends up being his credit through the thing. It actually gets said once in the actual script, and then that's his name in the credits.
Well, so it gets said by all the other boys, which I think is a great illustration of their utter mayhem on this set. They're like, fine, if you're not going to give me a name, fucking Don't Ask it is. And they all use it and yell it in the food fight scene. And I love it. I think
that's the problem with doing films with kids, is they're just going to try to take control. They're going to give each other their own characters' names.
But I also just want to point out, like, how... These kids, I bet this is like a core fucking memory. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
I bet this was the greatest time of their lives. And it's just something they're never going to forget. It was such a blast. It was so beautiful. It was so imaginative. It was all these great things. I just feel like this would be the coolest cast to be a part of, even if you never worked in Hollywood again as a kid that age. Like, you would just... It would be glorious, I think. And even Dustin Hoffman's kids are in the movie. The set was apparently very popular for kids. John Voight's kids came to set, including Angelina Jolie, who wanted to, like, meet Captain Hook. Like, she was, like, 16, and she was like, I want to meet Captain Hook, and came to set. So
poor fucking Steven Spielberg. He's like, I'm already dealing with, paying all these kids and trying to get them to do their fucking jobs, and now everyone else's kids want to come hang out on my set? Mm-hmm. Jesus. Also, I
fucking love kids, so, like, I just think this would be so fun. I just thought, like, we have different vibes about this, because
I've been a middle school teacher. This sounds
true.
Like my
personal That's totally, totally different vibe. Totally hear you.
I want to apologize to those that are on video today, because this rim is just constantly getting stuck in my stash, so I apologize for the...
If it makes you feel any better, I can't even tell. I mean, I'm, like, looking right at you.
I'm just going to be grossing people out all day.
But today. Like, just do the, you should have hooked your stash today.
It's not long enough yet. I'm growing it back in. If I'd known a while ago, I wouldn't have trimmed it down. Sorry.
Dang it. He hasn't done the full blown hook as in this movie, but he has hooked the stash before. It can be done. So I'm just saying. All right. Well, next time we'll just edit this video later when your stash is hooked again. Okay. Really quick plot summary. I don't know that we need it, because it's probably quite clear what this is about. But anyway, when Captain James Hook kidnaps his children, an adult Peter Pan must return to Neverland and reclaim his youthful spirit in order to challenge his old enemy.
The phrasing of that summary sounds like Captain Hook is kidnapping his own children. Like, he has an ex-wife somewhere that he doesn't have custody. It's like, when Captain Hook kidnaps his children, Peter's like, no, that's not how the law works, Cap.
Your mission today is make this movie darker than it is. That's what I'm hearing.
Like, it's pretty fucking dark. They talk about kids dying in this.
And they kill actual children. Okay, sorry, spoilers.
That's what I was going to say.
It gets gnarly. It does get gnarly. I'll give you that for sure.
There is a throwaway line where Captain Hook says, yes, I've been killing lost boys for years. This is a world where the kids seem to think, like, it's all fun and games, and the pirates are stabbing them.
I think it's clear that Hook is a bad guy, but in this version, he's kind of a lovable bad guy. Like, I know he talks about killing kids, but I think this is kind of a love letter to Hook, to be honest. It's called Hook, right? Like, there's a reason for this, you know? I think it becomes this really wholesome story about this family, of course, but, I mean, we're kind of obsessed with Hook throughout, is all I'm saying.
You're getting me excited. Can we just throw the spoiler tag down?
Let's do it. Yeah, you guys have had plenty of time to watch this movie. So just a heads up, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time.
So you just had my wheels turning of, yes, Hook is the best part of the... Hook and Smee together are the best part of this film.
Oh my God, Hook and Smee.
I was rewatching it. Just the two of them, their dynamic is incredible. You never really know, like, do they love each other? Do they hate each other? Are they, like, a bickering old couple? Is that what this dynamic is? But just...
All of the above.
You saying how much we end up loving Hook. He's going through sort of, like, not even a midlife crisis.
Existential crisis.
Yeah. Symbiotic relationship with Peter Pan where
he needs
to pursue him. Because that was my question, was why does he even give a shit that Peter Pan left Neverland. He's miserable. He's a lawyer. He's going to die at 62 of a heart attack, presumably.
100%.
He's going to get a divorce, and Hook's like, nope, now's the time. I got to kidnap him and bring him back here to kill him. It just, he needs this energy in his life.
Well, I think, okay, I think a couple things are true. One, he can't access Peter except through this nursery where this imagination is at the source. You know what I mean? Like, this is the open window. This is the place that you can get to
these children. Drew that conclusion. Okay, that makes sense.
And so I think that's like part of why it happens right now is all I'm saying. He's back. Like, he's literally back. So he's accessible. But I also think, I totally agree with you, his life just, like, they are foils of each other. He has no point without Peter. And he says it over and over again, my best and most worthy enemy, right? Yeah. Like, he's like, you are the only one who makes it worthwhile. Like, kids are easy. Like, I've been killing Lost Boys for generations, right? Killing Lost Boys, killing Indians. Sorry, I didn't say that. They say, like, that's what happens in the movie.
They point out in the movie that Peter can't read. Neverland is not an educated community. And there's a lot of racism. Place. They are stuck in the past.
My God. And even, like, if you watch the Disney version, it's the same shit. There's a lot of, like, misrepresentations. It's really bad. But anyway, those targets for him are low-hanging fruit. They're so easy. It's not an adventure. And Hook is all about, like, I got to have this adventure. And I'm a pirate. And I'm supposed to be able to tell these legendary stories of my battles and blah, blah, blah. And to date, that's really only been Peter. And I need him back to, like, have that validation of my own self-worth and all these things. And so, like, he is very much, I think, having this incredible existential crisis. And I think it yields all these hilarious interactions of just him, you know, losing it and not believing this is Peter. That whole first interaction between the two of them, to mm-hmm. me, is just hysterical. The one-liners, the moving the eye patch to the wrong eye, the, like, just him roasting him. And he's like, this is not Peter. Like, you're overweight. You, like, are not in fighting shape. Like, there's no way that this is the guy. I just love how much shit they give him when he gets there of, like, mm-hmm. you're not even close. Like, this is, it's, and then, like, he challenges him to be like, okay, go save your kids. Like, if you can do it, go save your kids. And the line, someone give me a hand. And Hook's like, I already have. And I was like, I fucking love this guy. God, I just,
yeah, he's been building up these roast battle one-liners for decades, and he's ready to go.
He's like, I'm ready to just battle so that we can just throw these zingers about. I have a whole cache of them. And this is another thing about him as a character that I love. Like, his diction, his word choice, his vocabulary is incredible. Even the way he talks to Smee, the way he talks to the crew, and he'll say something and it'll be like, Smee, do translate. You know, like, they don't understand him because he's so eloquent in the way he does.
He's playing it in the perfect way. Hoffman is the best part of this film. Robin Williams is a close second, but Hoffman just, it doesn't feel cartoony. It feels like a character for sure, but it does not feel cartoony. And yeah, the way that he's speaking so proper and so eloquently, like, I totally agree with you on that. It also gives us the most kid-friendly suicide joke that we've all ever seen. We get that scene because of his existential crisis. So let's talk about that.
It's true. He is, well, I have to just double tap. He is the best part about this movie. And I agree with you. He plays it chef's kiss perfect. He's committed to the bit, but he is wholly Hook. Like, that's the thing. Like, you completely buy into him being Hook. And when he does that scene, number one, I love his cabin. Can we take a moment for the incredible cabin that is Captain Hook's cabin? It's ornate. It's beautiful. It has a little, like, fake sea where he can play out these fake battles, because apparently he is an infant and he's been just fantasizing about his battles with Peter Pan. And Smee pulls out his shoe drawer of 20 pairs of the same set of shoes, and his bed comes floating down from the ceiling. And I just, like, it's the set is incredible. Like, we have to acknowledge across the board, The entire set is incredible.
Yeah.
They're gorgeous. And to your point, I think they are a little reminiscent of like a Jim Henson kind of work as well. But yeah, I just love that whole scene of Smee babying him and putting him to bed and trying to reassure him. And he's like, yeah, he's like threatening suicide, but he's doing it this way. Like, don't you dare stop me. Don't you dare stop me. And he says it over and over. And he's like, Smee, stop me. And don't scare me like that again. And I love that it becomes him, the guy who is supposed to be doing the scary thing. Don't scare me like that again, that you won't stop me. And it does it like, it doesn't quite age well, don't get me wrong, but even now, the way that he plays it,
I was laughing my ass off.
You're still chuckling.
Granted, I know that is not going to land for everybody, and there are going to be people who are upset about that joke, but I was laughing. So
it's still funny today. I don't know why. Like, again, the way he plays it is very funny.
Apparently, Bob Hoskins and Dustin Hoffman assumed their characters were gay. Like, that was their belief, and that's the way they chose to act the scenes of, yeah, they're this bickering couple that have been together for a long time. And I think Spielberg caught wind of it and was like, that is not what is happening here. Like, please don't play it that way, because I don't need a tender kiss or whatever on screen. We're not there yet. But yeah, that was like the way that they chose to play their scenes. And I think it makes a lot more sense to think of them as, you know, men in their 50s that have been together for a couple decades and resent each other.
Well, they're certainly companions. You know what I mean? They're certainly lifelong companions who have lived with each other maybe a little too long and, you know, don't have a tolerance for certain things and know exactly how to handle other things, you know? So. But yes, their dynamic plays perfectly. I mean, all the way to the end when the war has started as well. So they're really interesting. But I do also want to pause on, you know, when this first interaction happens with Hook and he tells him to try and save the kids. And, you know, he's got to battle his fear of heights to go up the mast and try to get to them and all these things. That one, it's really sad how it ends because he does give up, of course, which I think is pretty terrible for a dad. Like, I don't care if you're not Peter Pan, like for a dad to give up on saving his kids plays pretty gnarly, you know?
Guess
like
I won't be saving my kids today. Yeah.
Guess I won't be saving my kids today. I guess they're just going to like hang out
no
in this
parent
net.
Ever. Yeah.
Exactly. Like it's almost unrealistic how bad they make him as a dad in that way. But my favorite part of that scene that like gives me a little levity in this really sad, terrible moment is Maggie being like, mommy could do it. And I was like, burn. You just got told, Dad.
Well,
like,
has any part of you thought that maybe he doesn't actually want to save them? Maybe he's like, you know what? This is my out. This pirate and all his people have stolen my kids. I just need to pack it up and leave. You know, Moira thinks they were kidnapped. I'm just saying.
I mean, it's an interesting question. I will say that. I think there's probably parts of him that want both, to be fair. Like,
we know he's unhappy. He's
heading
for divorce
there, though,
way.
And he even like tries to coerce the Lost Boys pretty early on in helping him save the kids. He doesn't yet believe he's Peter Pan, of course, but he's like, I gotta save my kids, though. But it could be interesting to think about it as, is that more obligation than it is that he actually wants them back? Like, that could be a thought. I think his tether early on is kind of his daughter, because he's not having the struggles with his daughter that he is with his son, you know? But he does really struggle with his son. His son does need him more and expect more from him and push back on him. And I think that's making him work as a dad, and he doesn't have time for that because he's got a different job to do. He's
I mean, to be fair, though, he no-shows the baseball game at the beginning, but the fucking kid strikes out anyway. So isn't it a good thing that he didn't show up for that choke job? Like, I came all the way here, and this is how you reward me? Like, Jack?
So Hook could win over your kid, too, is what I'm hearing. He'd be like...
It'd be super easy.
They'd be like, sold. 100%. No problem. I just love that, one, he shows up so late to that game, but two, he sends that fucking random guy to video it. And
I do like that bit.
Yeah. He's like...
And he's cheering.
Who's your kid? Go ahead. And he like films the whole thing. Anyway, it's
the
so
fact
bad.
That, yeah, the Peter Banning character apparently doesn't know how long baseball games last. Everyone is gone. It's not even like he shows up
they're
after
not,
the game.
They're not moseying out. It's been a fucking while, and he doesn't understand, because he's never been to a game probably, right? Like, that's the whole point, I think. He has no idea. But
it's science.
But I think to your point of maybe some things that could be frustrating about this movie is that early on, again, he is so bad as a dad that he like feels unredeemable probably for a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I love all the zingers directed at him early on. There are so many, like from the Pirates, from the Lost Boys, from his kids. Like, I love that his mind's been gentrified comment from Smee. Like, there are just all these great zingers directed at him. And I think it's a fun, just reflection of like how lame you are when you just go full blown adult. You know, everyone here thinks you and your adulting bullshit is boring and lame and, you know, not a part of this adventure, this universe at all. And I just love that he kind of gets roasted throughout early on for all of that.
I mean, at the same time, though, we said before, what the fuck do kids know? Why do I give a shit what a child thinks? Like, I can buy as much alcohol and cocaine as I want, kid. Can't do either of those legally.
Legally, you can buy cocaine legally. That's news to me. That's brand new information. Let's
go. I do want to say, though, because we kind of jumped right into Neverland, and one of, I think, the weak points for me on rewatch was it takes so long for us to get to Neverland. Like, this is a 2-hour, 20-minute yeah. film.
It is a little long. Drag. I will agree with that totally.
And that intro of just, okay, we get it. He's a bad guy. Like, I didn't look up how long it actually takes for us to get to Neverland, but I did feel like it dragged. And then it picks up. As soon as we get there, it picks up.
I want to say it's almost an hour. I'm ballparking like 45 minutes.
I was thinking
plus.
Like 30 to 40 minutes, and that still feels too long to get there.
I think it's like 45-ish just from, because I had to pause it a couple of times, as you know, I've been traveling, whatever. So I was catching up and I feel like I paused it at one point around the hour mark and we were maybe had just gotten there, you know, something like that. So it is a long time. And actually, I agree with you. And Skylar actually said the same thing. He was like, I know where this is going and I just want to get to Neverland. Like, this whole part takes too long. And I agree with you. You can make the point, you've made it very quickly, actually, how bad of a dad he is and how not present he is without it taking this much time. Like, I totally agree with that.
I think that's a Spielberg thing, though, of we talked about it with Jurassic Park, how that movie is like these sets of reveals over and over again. And we don't see the T-Rex until X amount of time into the movie. With this, I feel like he's building up to, we want to go to Neverland, we want to go there. But he's just keeping you on the hook too long until it finally happens.
Yeah. And I think part of it is he feels like he has to really set up the story. And I think it makes the payoff stronger for in his view. I think he feels like it makes the payoff stronger because you have this just like complete trajectory that's the opposite of who he was at the beginning. And he becomes a totally different person and all these things. And so I don't think you feel the impact of that as much without seeing how obsessed he is. But yeah, I agree. I think it could be a bit more succinct for sure. And I think he makes it clear that he cares about, and this is to your point before we get to Neverland, like you see that he cares about Wendy, that she's very important to him. Granny Wendy is very important to him, but he is almost like disassociated from this origin story. You know what I mean? I think that the theme for me with Peter throughout this movie is like his constant state of amnesia. He just fucking forgets everything that happens to him, whether it's
when
his
child. Yeah, when he's Peter Banning, he forgets that he's Peter Pan. When he's Peter Pan, he forgets he's Peter Banning.
Forgets that he's Peter Banning. Yeah. Exactly. And it's like, it's just him trying to remember things and reconnect to those things. And
That Peter Pan has like CTE? Like, did he get concussed as a Lost Boy a million
times?
Listen,
he definitely fell several times as a Lost Boy. So there is the real possibility.
It could also be that he's fucking 300 years old, like unofficially. Like, he never grew up, but maybe your brain still ages. Who knows?
To be fair, he's probably forgotten more than we know, to be honest. So yeah, I think that's a real, I think there's a real problem for Peter throughout. All of the iterations of Peter forgets some key fucking shit throughout. And I think one of the main things too is, again, like his relationship with Wendy, and that gets kind of weird throughout, because you see like the iterations of their relationship.
Yeah.
And you can tell that she loved him and all the things. And you get more of that backstory that makes that feel more natural and all of that. And that's okay. But you get these hints early on of this relationship was different at one point, and now she's kind of a matronly figure to him, but he once loved her and she once loved him in this different way. And you, in the original Peter Pan, of course, you're always rooting for Peter and Wendy. I mean, that's literally the name of the story at the beginning, right? Peter and Wendy. So it's really sad to me to see that early on of him like having this distance with her and not remembering these stories. And
but meanwhile, she does.
But she does. And it's so painful for her to remember and him not, you know. And it's beautiful, I think, that she has her feet in both worlds a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. she can't go back to Neverland. She says that. She's forgotten how to fly, all these things. But she cherishes those memories and she holds them close to her heart. And she expects the people in her home to, you know, honor that legend of like, don't grow up and be a child here and enjoy your childhood and be in this beautiful nursery full of imagination. And I think that's what makes one of her characters the most interesting, the most powerful, because she can appreciate both, you know. And maybe that's one of those things, again, that comes with age, is remembering the beauties of childhood that you didn't maybe appreciate as much as you should have when, you know, when you were trying too hard to become an adult. But I love Wendy as a character in this iteration specifically. She's really interesting.
Yeah. I remembered as a kid thinking this part was like scary. And as an adult, I felt bad for that, but I also laughed. But when they're doing the flashback, which is one thing that does not land for me, where we're getting all the, here's what happened and here's how we got here. Like 2 hours into the movie, they explain everything.
Oh, you mean him, like running away as a baby? That
yeah, let's
you
dig
mean?
Into that. I want to start though with like the recoil from old lady Wendy. Like, I'm like, yeah. As a kid, I remember being like, oh God, she's old. But as an adult, you're like, oh, I feel bad for doing that. But I'm also laughing because Peter's like, hey, Wendy. And she turns around and his hand recoils. But and then he's like, well, I guess I'll just, you know, marry your granddaughter? Granddaughter,
it was
right?
Her granddaughter. Yeah. At that point. Yeah.
And I'm like, that's kind of fucked up, Peter. I think that's what I'm learning through this movie, is Peter's not the best guy, honestly.
I think Peter has like an ongoing identity crisis. You know, he's just not really sure what he wants. But I think it's supposed to be sweet that he sees Moira and is like, you know, love at first sight kind of thing of like, this could be the thing that makes me stay. But also like, you can't ignore that that's kind of hurtful to Wendy, right? And I'm like, she went back and she loved you and all these things. But I will say, asterisk, about the flashback, that is from the source material. They did use it like more effectively than anybody else has. So like, it is supposed to be, which is crazy, but it is supposed to be that he was able to like run away as a baby because he didn't want to, he didn't want to grow up and all these things.
Again,
and so,
it's fantasy. I get it. I kind of wish they hadn't recorded, like filmed the scene. Like, don't show a newborn in a pram running away from their parent, like just rolling down a hill, toppling over and laying in the rain. It just didn't
like
really
a baby laying in the rain crying is pretty terrible. Yeah. It's
but like that. Oh, I ran away. And then he says something about, I realized in that moment that everyone would die. And that's why I chose to run away. What the fuck? And then he says,
it's magic, Lamar. Okay. It's magical.
Yes. No, I hear but you. Then it's also when he goes back and he looks in and his parents have a new child. And he's like, they had forgotten about me. It's like, I get it when you're a kid, if you feel that way, kind of like Catch Me If You Can. We talked about that scene where he's looking in through the window. You're a fucking adult. You have been dead, quote unquote, for however many years. Your parents have a new baby. They're happy. And you're going to be like, they forgot about me. Go fuck yourself.
But I think that's the thing about Neverland, right? Is like, you have no sense of time.
It makes you selfish. Oh, you have no sense of time.
It makes you selfish. It makes you selfish. And you have no sense of time. Or you have a fear of time. Or you're avoiding time. Like, even Peter says that to Hook later. And I think it's one of the most profound things he says. He's like, Hook is afraid of time. Like, Hook's fear is time, right? And so I think that's the difference between Neverland and the real world, is like, you just have this disconnect with the passage of time and how it impacts others. So when you come back and you can't relate to the new Wendy because she's so much older and all these things, like, you detach from that a little bit. And I think it gets a little harsh for him on a couple of occasions, but I do think they demonstrate really well what a sweet and beautiful character Wendy is. And I think it's actually an homage a little bit to J.M. Barrie, because he donated, if you didn't know this, he donated in his will, he left all the rights and the proceeds to all the Peter Pan properties to that hospital that they reference at the beginning of the film.
Oh, okay.
So he does do that. And that is something that like has sustained that hospital for forever. Right. That's been something that he has done. And that is remembered to this day. Like, he, I think it's the what is it called? It's the Great Ormond Street Hospital. They're still funded to this day by the proceeds from those things. And he did do that. So cool. I think it's sweet that they included that here in that way. But yeah, that's like the most wholesome part to this point. And then you go back to Peter just forgetting about his kids and then forgetting about his grandma Wendy or Granny Wendy, and then becoming Peter again and forgetting everything else. Like, he just, his vacillating amnesia is a lot for me throughout this, I will say.
It's a lot. And it's weird to see Robin Williams, at least for the first 30, well, first probably 60 to 90 minutes of the movie, playing a not Robin Williams-esque character, even as a kid. It's like, I know who this guy is, and he always makes me laugh. So to have him having to play a straight man, and that's just the nature of the film, right? But
right.
I do like when we get that first taste of truly Robin Williams' greatest talents, when Tink shows up and she's in the little house and he does the whole, she's like, do you even know who I am? And he does the thing about, you're a hallucination. You probably have something to do with my mother. And, yes. And he's like, but you have really nice legs. Like, that is just that line of dialogue. I wouldn't be surprised if Robin Williams was just going off the cuff with that, because that is just pure RW.
And I think he has so many of those moments in the adult form as well throughout, where he makes all these funny, sharp quips and references. He's like, what is this, Lord of the Flies in training? Like, he's like, says these things throughout that you're like, these are just, they're so adult. They're not him as Peter Pan, and they're so snarky and funny and witty. But then I also think you have that moment where he becomes Peter and you're like, he's so good. He's so good as Peter. He's like the perfect person to be Peter, and he can flip that right away. And I think that's something that is really reminiscent of Robin Williams as an actor. And like, even, you know, Dustin Hoffman said that about working with him, is like, there was just these two sides to him. You had these two totally different personalities that you worked with. And one was like, you'd never want to raise this child in your home, but he's incredible to work with and is a great time. But then he also can capture this very like adult side and these adult emotions and feelings. So I do think for this specific story, it could probably not have been better cast.
And that quote of Hoffman's, like, that rings different now, you know? It's really depressing to think about. And I think for a lot, even me personally, I think, you know, what happened with Robin Williams and that tragedy, like, really illuminated a lot of mental health issues, like, not specifically to men, but just in general, of just a lot of times the people who are the entertainers and the funny people, like, are going through some shit, or they're afraid of letting their guard down. And I think that Hoffman's quote there about Robin Williams, and how he had these two sides, like, that's really telling.
And it really shows up in this film. And I think one of the ways it shows up really beautifully is when, you know, they're in Neverland, he's with the Lost Boys, he's trying to convince them to help him, but he's not trying to convince them that he's Peter. Rufio has drawn literally the line in the sand and said, like, who doesn't believe that he's Peter and who does? And this little boy, who is the most precious little boy, by the way, just to begin with, you know, is like trying to give him a chance and is like trying to figure out, is this Peter? And I just love the whole scene where he's playing with his face and he's feeling everything and he's moving around and he forces him to smile. And as soon as he squishes his face and makes him smile, he just like, it gets me every time. Like, I will tear up. He's like, oh, there you are, Peter. And it's like this just most precious moment. And all the Lost Boys move.
I was going to say, like, and then we see the peer pressure of, they're like, oh, yes, yes. And then they just keep running back and forth. And it's like, kids are stupid is what we're learning from this film.
We're learning that that kids love joy. Okay. And he was smiling and it was precious. And don't ruin this for me, Lamar.
Okay.
But anyway, I thought that was a very sweet scene of flipping that script of, this is a, there's the boy inside of the man, you know, there's the sweet, joyous boy inside of this man who has forgotten all of this, and he can come back and he can be brought back. And then you get this whole sequence where he is and he does. And I think it's telling too, that the thing that finally gets him to fly is remembering that he's a daddy and that he wanted to be a dad specifically. He wanted to be a father and that his kids are the most important thing to him. But he has to kind of go through this like roller coaster of trying to remember a happy thing, a happy moment, and go back to that moment where he remembers the birth of his son and is becoming a dad.
that sequence, for as much as some of the emotional moments in this, and I'm sure we've already mentioned a couple, but like some of the stuff doesn't land for me anymore. But that yeah. sequence where he is in, I think it's like the hollowed out tree, and he's remembering everything from there, but then he's spinning off of that into his happy thoughts about his kids. Mm-hmm. I think that, to your point earlier about he's having a hard time balancing these two personalities. It seems like he can yeah. be one or the other, and that's when he finally learns to embrace both.
Yeah, and I think like he does vacillate for a second, though, I will say. You know, he goes back, and when he's talking to Tink in her little apartment, and he sort of forgets. That's one of the moments that doesn't fit well for me, where
no.
Tink gets big and she professes her love to him and all these things.
Where did that come from?
It's just so out of left field. It still doesn't work. She also gives up pretty easily for somebody who's been waiting all this time to become this big thing and do this thing and have this moment, and it lasts for 10 seconds, and she tells him to go off and save his kids. And it is, I will say, the only thing as far as tonality is, it is reminiscent of Tink as the character being kind of selfish about Peter and yeah. forgetting that he has other responsibilities and things, like she did in the original. Like, she just wants him to herself.
I think that's true, but they could have played that if that was the way they were going. Because I told Janelle, I was like, in the original cartoon, like, Tink definitely had feelings for Peter and was jealous of yeah. every other woman they interacted with. But they didn't really address, they seem more like friends throughout this whole thing, and she's trying to guide him. But it never feels like there's anything romantic there. So for this to happen, and this wish, I don't even know, remember when she makes the wish, it just happens, it seems. Mm-hmm. And then she's big, they have a kiss. It's weird. It doesn't feel earned. Peter's definitely getting divorced when he gets back to the real world, because he's kissed three mermaids and one pixie. So sorry, Peter. It's just rough.
It is rough. I will say, I think that's so funny that they show him kissing all the mermaids. They're trying to oxygenate him, and he is trying to kiss them. And I'm like, you're missing the memo. Like, they are trying to literally just give you oxygen. They are just not that into you, Peter. And he's very like, oh, we're making out now. I'm like, Peter, get your shit together. No, I agree. It does not feel earned. It feels super weird at that point. And it doesn't last. It feels like something that should just be cut. And I don't know if that was like a deference to Tink having her moment and Julia Roberts getting her moment. But yeah, it's one of the few I will say, like, I don't feel like it fits.
And if mermaids exhale oxygen, we need to start manufacturing mermaids, because honestly, they're better to look at than trees. And then, you know, we need more apartments in Austin, more complexes. So it's just,
we'll get on that. Everywhere. I mean, you've been inspired now. Just go make it happen. I don't understand. I do want to call out a few good things. We have these great scenes that are really fun. The food fight scene and the imagination scene is really cool and a good time. I think it's again that progression of him like fully coming into Neverland and like starting to get it. And it's funny to me that it took insults to get the lawyer to lean into Neverland. Like, the insult battle was the thing that triggered it for him. And I was like, checks out, you know, that works. But I love how the food fight commences and the aesthetic of that scene, and like just how, again, like the feel and vibe of that scene feels really like fun and wholesome. And I think that tonality is actually carried on into the battle later. Even though it's a battle, it feels like, again, it's like a kid battle. You know, they're
110%.
And they're using the chicken egg gun and the marbles. And like, they're just like, I feel like it's on brand. I feel like it's like, that's the tone with these kids.
Again, I think, like, to my point at the beginning of, it's half kids movie and half adult movie. And then occasionally they mash up, but it's not seamless. We have heard Captain Hook say that he has murdered children, and we see him stab a child through the heart. And meanwhile, the kids are like using mirrors. And I'm like, is this fun and games, or is this actual war? Because people are dying. It just, the tone, that's why it's a kids movie, but it just feels weird.
The tone feels mixed to you.
Yeah.
Which I can hear that and respect that. I think it's true. I think it can be true, I should say. I watch it as the kids are still innocent. That's the difference. Like, they are in Neverland because they don't want to grow up, and they do want to be innocent, and they do want to think of, you know, childish solutions to adult problems, you know, like, I want to simplify things that you think are complicated and darker and harder than they should be. And so I think it's kind of that's the battle here, is between mm-hmm. like the mentality of a kid, which is innocent and rooted in joy and yes, shenanigans and antics, but also like not darkness, versus these darker themes of being a pirate and being an adult and like all these things that are like just indirect contrast. I think I think it's intentional is what I'm saying, but I can see how it like maybe doesn't quite land for everybody.
Another question I had was, so does that mean that like all the pirates, do they not age either? Because it seems like Captain Hook is getting older, but
I think like, the pirates have aged. I think they're people who have aged. And I think it's like, I think it's a conscious decision, and they don't go into it here, but I think it's a conscious decision to let yourself grow up when you're in Neverland. You know okay, what I mean? Like okay. you're deciding to grow up there versus you can be a lost boy and decide not to grow up, you know? And I think the pirates are the ones who decided to grow up and have gone to the dark side, so to speak. And I think like that's the battle here, you know?
I think that's fair. I didn't know if like the pirates were adults from the real world who would somehow come to Neverland of like, you know, when you run out of Tinder matches in Austin, you go to Neverland and then you just become a pirate and you fight children all day.
You got to diversify. You know, you got to try somewhere else and then you turn into a pirate because it doesn't work out. Yeah, I think that's the natural trajectory for the Austin dating scene.
The fight scene, the Rufio's death, I remember being bummed when I was a kid. But on rewatch, again, it rings a little hollow. The rest of the kids don't even seem to react to it.
They don't give the kids enough of a reaction, I think. I agree. I think it becomes a moment between Rufio and Peter, and that's really rough, and it kind of inspires Peter to make certain choices. But yeah, it would have been nice, because like they've led all the kiddos for – he's led all the kiddos for quite a long time in Peter's absence, and it does feel like they don't get as much of a reaction to that. I agree. But – I do think it's part of the impetus for like Hook and Peter to really battle, because if not, he's just there to save his kids at this point. Like you see him turn away from the battle with Hook and let Rufio have that battle because he's like, my priority is this. But you also like can't not have the payoff of him and Hook battling, you know? So there's got to be a reason that that happens. And I think like from a plot device standpoint, it makes sense to me.
I just wanted them to pause though when he says looky looky I got hooky, and then a narrator would pause and it's like he didn't have hooky
but he didn't. Yeah, it was a sad ending for Rufio, I do remember, but I do like their battle and it being like the thing that brings him back to it is I'm going to come back for your kids and your kids' kids. And like that need to protect that lineage becomes the impetus for them to really face off. My one criticism of this whole thing, I will say, is that it does last a little too long. Like I said, this whole thing could be more condensed for sure.
Again, 2-hour and 20-minute film. And like, yeah if they cut it's out long. Some of the, I hate the thud butt, like putting his legs up to his ears and then you get this fake body rolling down
that
the stairs.
That is a cheesy,
Don't love that. Mm-hmm. Do like the sword fight. I think the last sword fight with Pan and Hook is pretty well choreographed. I love when Cook gets knocked down and he goes to help him up and he has that spiteful little, I'm just going to put this little scratch on your arm to be an asshole.
Yeah.
Like that made me laugh really hard this time around. But yeah, it just, I
like that Hook always gets eaten by the crocodile. Like, I mean, like,
he
it's
can't get away
big,
from that fucking crocodile.
He just can't get away from that fucking crocodile. He can't get away from the ticking clock, which is, by the way, one of the only moments I think I can identify with Hook. I'm like, listen, a fucking ticking clock, like, also enraging. I get it.
He has that museum of clocks that he broke. I like that's
that
his, like, happy place. Yeah.
I know. I mean, to be fair, how satisfying would that be? Like, that whole scene is, like, kind of fun. But yeah, that's the only thing. But I just love that he can't get away from that fucking crocodile every time. It's going to get him every time. Even in death, it's going to get him every time.
I was going to say, the crocodile's not still alive, right? It burps.
No, it just falls. It just falls on him.
But it burps.
Like, I think that's supposed to be like something to do with the clock mechanism, but I don't know. Like, I agree with you. It's a little.
I thought that was
there.
Another example of like, oh, kids love burps. They're going to laugh. Let's throw this in here, even though it doesn't fucking make sense.
I mean,
sense.
It probably was to make a burp happen. Yeah, I would not be surprised.
And then the only other part of that last fight I don't like is when he's being held down by Hook, and then they do the whole, like, I believe in you, Peter. I believe in you. And it's like...
Okay, but that's very important, because that is from the play. Like, that is how you save... If you believe, then they will live. So, like, it's how you save Tink. If she's going to die, you have to clap, and you have to say that you believe, and you have to believe in Neverland. You have to believe in Peter Pan.
Why didn't anybody believe in Rufio? What the fuck?
I know, Mikasa? Right? Well, Peter's not dead yet. You know what I mean? Like, he hasn't been straight up stabbed. Like, there's a place to come back from, is all I'm saying at this point.
I feel like, you know, Rufio did nothing wrong. I hate how when Peter figures out who he is, Rufio kneels down and he's like, you are Pan. And he takes the sword and pretends like it. And it's like the punishment, you fucking usurper. It's like, you've been gone for decades, dude.
Yeah.
And this guy took over for you. And it's taking care of all these kids, and you're going to show up.
I don't think it's supposed to be a punishment. I think it's supposed to be an acknowledgement. I will say. I think it's like, hey, you made it back, guy. Here you go. Like, I don't think it's supposed to be a punishment. And the stance is just the Peter stance. I don't think it's supposed to be intimidating. Like, that's his power pose. And I don't read that part as a punishment. But I mean, I get what you're saying. But I think he's just supposed to be like, there you are. You're here. Like, you've made a believer out of me. And like, they've bonded. They've gone through their little story arc. But overall, I think this movie is such a great time, and it's so wholesome. There's a couple little things I wanted to point out. The passing of the sword is improvised, which I think is so sweet. Steven Spielberg and Robin Williams were the only ones who knew which of the Lost Boys that Robin Williams was going to hand it to. And like, so their reactions in that moment are real, and they're very excited. And it's like a little pure moment to me. Another one I love is that Toodles at the end, who's back in the real world, who has been saying he's losing his marbles and all these things. He was a lost boy, and he gets his marbles back, which, for reference, his marbles are his happy thoughts. And so he gets those back, and he's very excited. But also, like, he references that he missed the adventure again. That's like a running joke in the books, is like, he always misses the adventure through some misfortune. Like, he wants to be there. He wants to be in the thick of it, and he always misses out. And so I like all these little sweet Easter eggs, and that it ends on the moment of Peter saying, you know, no, to live will be an awfully big adventure. And that's
you like that play. Recurring line throughout of, yeah, death is the only adventure you have left. And I think as an adult, that line does hit different of like, yeah, have I done all the like cool shit in my life at this point? Am I just, you know, I think that is sort of a midlife crisis type question, right? Like, what is left? So to live will be an awfully big adventure. That hits home as an adult.
It does. It's sweet. And it's from the play. So like, I love all the things about that.
You said that thing about Toodles always missing all the action and whatnot. What, mm-hmm. Did you know he's a draft dodger? He did not go
shit.
So go ahead. Do your research, people. It's important to get on the dark web. Find out what you need to know about Toodles.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, did I miss the war?
Again with Lamar trying to end on controversy and darkness. Thanks. Thanks so much. Well, with that in mind, and in the interest of time, what would you close out with your rating?
Well, I'm going through, I know that we have breezed through Hook, and sorry if you wanted this episode to be longer. There's just so much we could talk about here. I did want to call out more cameos that we missed. You have Glenn Close as the opening pirate. You have Phil Collins as a lawyer. You have George Lucas and Carrie Fisher, who apparently rewrote some bits of the screenplay because I think she was going to originally play
Tinkerbell. She's a prolific writer, if y'all didn't know that about her. She's actually a very good writer, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if she was slated to play Tinkerbell or she was just the inspiration because of George
Lucas. She was like the muse of
Tinkerbell. So she helped out with some of that dialogue. You have Jimmy Buffett as a pirate, and you have Gwyneth Paltrow in her second film. And I didn't know that she was Steven Spielberg's goddaughter. So that explains a lot, actually, because I can't name many Gwyneth Paltrow films that I love where she doesn't get decapitated. Okay.
Again, with the darkness. What is your rating, sir? Let's get there.
My rating, I'm going to take the fact that even Spielberg himself said he didn't really love this one. He didn't love the final cut of the product. He was happy that he has this memory of Robin Williams because they became friends on this. But I'm with him where I don't think this is a bad film, but as an adult, it does not hit the same as it did when I was a childhood. Me would have said this was like 8.5, 9, damn near perfect film. Adult me is going to give it like a 6. Like, it's fun. I will not say that it's not a fun film, but I don't think it's a great film. Could have been shorter. could have gotten rid of some of the visual effects have not aged as well as Jurassic Park, despite these only being a couple years apart. There's some rough green screen in this and little things that stand out. But I think if I had more of an appreciation for the source material like you do, or I was more of like a fairy tale type, if you watch this as a fairy tale, you probably have a great time. But not for me as an adult. So I'll give it like a 6.
I'm like a 7. I mean, I think it's like a 7, 7.5 for me. Probably more 7.5 because of the nostalgia and the source material. I love Peter Pan, as we have established. I think that like the works and the story behind it and even just like the historical, how this story came to be is really beautiful to me. And I think Spielberg's problem with this film is like the filmmaking process was not that joyful for him, obviously, like, and
way
he,
over budget, way over budget,
really yeah. hard to manage these people. And so, but I don't think that's a reflection, like reflected as much in the final product. I think the final product is really joyful and magical in a lot of ways. I do think it drags in some places. I do think certain jokes like don't quite land anymore. So that's why I would temper that rating a little bit. But I do think it's just, if you watch it again with like childlike eyes, it can be a really fun film.
Yeah, your kids will love this movie. I'm not saying it's a bad, but your children will love it.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think the source material and the moral of the story of like to get to connect with your childhood and with your childlike, you know, self is a really good moral and a fun story to tell. So
even if it means getting somebody else killed, you know,
I mean,
Tink is to blame for Rufio's death. Captain Hook was like, I don't want to fight him. And she's like, 3 days. And then you get your war. Fucking Rufio would still be alive if not for Tinkerbell.
Because Tinkerbell is a bit selfish. Like we said, she just wants Peter back is what this comes down to. So yeah. I get that. Anyway. All right, y'all. Thanks for joining and listening us to debate all things Hook, which I didn't expect, but it was a good time. Come back next week for our next Spielberg with some special guests. Oh, and we will be covering Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Widely regarded to be the best one. I think widely regarded by kids my age. When I was a kid, that was my favorite one. So we'll talk about that next week.
We will. We will get into that. We will have a lot of feelings and thoughts about that. But anyway, In the meantime,
follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, mostly on Instagram, TikTok. We got reels and whatnot headed your way. Feel free to message us any ideas you have. Also on YouTube or even on Spotify now, you can watch our video. So if you're a fan of seeing me take things out of my mustache, or Mackenzie, you didn't even show your shirt. You said you were supposed to show your shirt today.
I am. Oh, yeah. So I just thought, and they don't mention it in this version of it, but Skull Rock is a big deal in Peter Pan. So I wore my Coheed and Cambria shirt with the big, like
Chris Buchert listening out there is going to be so happy that you're wearing a Coheed and Cambria shirt. That's like his favorite band. He has a tattoo of theirs.
I love Coheed. And you'll see later, Lamar, why this works for our other movie as well. Anyway, I wanted to be on brand today.
Well, there you go.
All right, homies. Well, thanks for joining. Come back next week, like we said. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Bangarang.
Bangarang.